For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Good evening, everyone. I'm very happy to have with us tonight Florence Kaplow, who's a Zen priest, but also a Unitarian Universalist minister from Urbana-Champaign, where she's the minister of the Universalist church there. Florence is also editor, co-editor of The Hidden Lamp, which she'll be speaking from tonight, a wonderful collection of teachings of the 25 centuries of wonderful women teachers and practitioners in the Buddhist tradition, with commentaries by modern American and other modern women teachers. Florence has a very interesting background as a conservationist, a botanist, an activist. She'll be speaking tomorrow evening at DePaul University about Zen practices for responding to all of the crises that face us in the world today. So there are flyers out front about that. She will have, there are copies of Hidden Lamp available for sale and that she can autograph if you wish after the talk in the kitchen during tea and treats. And so thank you very much for coming again to speak with us, Florence.
Good evening. Thank you for your interest and willingness to hear the stories and teachings and wisdom of women tonight. I'm going to start with a story. You're going to hear a sort of waterfall of stories tonight. And so I'm just going to start with the story, and then we'll go from there. And just to warn you that you may hear a few things tonight which may be a little shocking to our Soto Zen nice Western ears. This one is just a warm-up. Probably one of the most famous koans about women in the Dharma that has come down to us through the centuries. The old woman's rice cakes. Deshan was a great scholar of the Diamond Sutra, but he was not a Chan practitioner. He was traveling south in search of the Dharma, carrying his commentaries, his voluminous commentaries, on the Diamond Sutra with him. In the course of his travels, he came across an old woman on the roadside selling tea and rice cakes. He asked her, "Who are you?" She responded, "I am an old woman selling rice cakes." When he asked if he could buy some refreshments from her, she inquired, "Venerable priest, what are you carrying in your bag?" He said, "I am a scholar of the Diamond Sutra, and here I have all my notes and commentaries." Hearing this, the old woman said, "I have heard that, according to the Diamond Sutra, past mind is ungraspable, present mind is ungraspable, and future mind is ungraspable. So where is the mind that you wish to refresh with rice cakes, O scholar? If you can answer this, you may buy a rice cake from me. If not, you will have to go elsewhere for refreshment." Deshan was unable to reply. The old woman then directed him to a Chan master nearby. Deshan burned all his notes and commentaries the next day. I want to say a little bit about the Hidden Lamp and also just a little tiny bit about koans. And I want to get a sense of Who's in the room here? How many of you are familiar with this book or have studied it to some degree? Okay. And how many of you feel like you know at least a little bit about Zen koans? Yeah, that's actually a trick question. Taigen probably... Did you raise your hand?
No.
It's okay. Whether you raised your hand or didn't raise your hand is completely fine. Part of what I'm going to be doing tonight, in our Soto tradition, we definitely explore koans. Those of you who are a part of this Zen Sangha have explored koans, I know, with Taigen and others. And we have a tradition of talking about them. The way that my longtime teacher, Zoketsu Norman Fisher, talks about them is there are family stories. And so we share them, we talk about them, we know them, they become part of who we are and part of our practice. And other Zen traditions have other ways of working with koans very intensively in a teacher-student relationship. Sue Moon and I have done, she's my co-editor on this book, have done a lot of teaching from these koans, and we do all kinds of playful things with them, from writing, using them as mirrors to look at our own lives and practice, or even enacting them, doing them as performance. What I'm going to do tonight is just offer them into this space and into your hearts without commenting on them. So when I read a story, I'll be talking in between them, but when I read one, I'm just going to allow some silence afterwards and just see where it lands in your body. Don't worry about trying to understand it. Don't worry about how smart or knowledgeable of Chinese or Japanese or Buddhist culture you are. Just see how you encounter it when you hear it. So I want to say also a little bit about the writing of The Hidden Lamp and where this came from. Some of you have probably heard this before. I think it was, I was thinking, so the book came out 6 years ago, almost to the day that I'm speaking right now. It was in very early November of 2013 that the book was published. And I traveled around the country. Sue and I both traveled around the country to many different centers teaching from the book in the spring of 2014. And one of the places I came was here, which I think is the last time I've taught specifically from The Hidden Lamp. So some of you heard it then. Some of you might not be as aware of the background of this book. However, if you've been around Buddhism and Buddhist teachings at all, and you were paying attention, you might have noticed that the voices of women traditionally have not been prominent, shall we say. In fact, not only the voices of women, the teachings of women, and even women teachers, we take this for granted now that there are women teachers, that there are women priests. I remember when we spoke about this book for one of the first times at San Francisco Zen Center, a longtime Zen person said that she began her Zen practice sometime in the mid-60s. And the first time she ever saw a woman in the teaching seat, which is offering the Dharma formally, was in 1985. So for the first 20 years of her Buddhist practice, she never saw someone with a body like hers in the teaching seat. And until fairly recently, perhaps the last 10 years, in Zen communities all over the world, the lineage was chanted every morning, and that lineage was entirely male. San Francisco Zen Center was one of the first places to begin chanting the names of women as well. And I don't know how it's done here. I know that Norman began in Jukai and in priest ordinations to give formerly two lineages, the traditional male lineage going back to the Buddha, and then a circular lineage with names of actually many of the women that are also in the Hidden Lamp. So that's the context of where we've been for a long time. And I, like others, noticed that silence, shall we say, that hiddenness of women's wisdom. But we all knew that they were out there. I would say a well-educated Zen person might know five stories, five koans that involved women. And so I just got curious and started collecting them. And when I got up to about 50, I realized that these needed to be in the world. These needed to change our understanding. And that was the genesis of the book. I then reached out to Sue Moon, who I knew was a wonderful writer and Dharma sister. She agreed to work on it with me. We found women all over the world to provide reflections to these stories. The stories come from all of the major Buddhist traditions, not just Zen, all the way from the time of the Buddha to nearly the present day. So that's a little background. What's interesting to me is that a lot of people might assume, I think I might have even assumed this, that these stories about women's practice would be sweet, would be compassionate. These are the images, right, we often have with the stereotype of women's spirituality, compassionate, motherly, kind, supportive, nurturing. I'll just say that if you have spent time with this book, you would know that that is not the flavor of a lot of these stories. There's in the Tenzo Kyokan Dogen's work, there is some discussion of the three minds that are helpful minds, and one is called grandmotherly mind, Roshin, which is sometimes described as nurturing mind, old mind. I think this, I'm going to suggest that this might be too narrow a view of grandmotherly mind. And again, based partly on these stories, I think there's pretty good evidence that that might not be the full picture of grandmotherly mind. I found I don't remember how I came across this, but just yesterday, today, I found a T-shirt online. And what it said on the front was, "Their first mistake was assuming I was just an old lady." That could be the motto of a lot of women in the Hidden Lamp. In fact, you could say, "Their first mistake was assuming I was just a woman." When we asked Norman Fisher, who important teacher for both Sue and for me, to write the foreword, and actually his first draft of the foreword made this same mistake. It talked about how about the importance of this kind of compassionate understanding to arise out of women's practice. And I said to Norman, take another look at these stories. So this is really interesting, right? What's going on here? What's going on? Maybe, just maybe, true grandmotherly mind is also wrathful mind. Do you know in Tibetan Buddhism, right, these images of the various bodhisattvas and emanations of the Buddha. And some of them are Tara, the beautiful young woman, pouring out healing energy into the world, right? But, you know, Tara has 21 manifestations. And some of those manifestations are wrathful. That is, you need that energy as well. You need that energy of no bullshit. And I think that these often nameless old women, not all nameless, and even younger women, are in a perfect position to call bullshit. Because they truly are people of no rank. No power, no rank. And so they can see things that those with name and rank and status and the right robes can't see as clearly. So I think of a lot of the women in the Hidden Lamp, rather than being like Kuan Yin, they are more like Manjushri, the bodhisattva of wisdom who has a sword. In fact, there's at least one woman in here, I'll be reading you this story, who shows up with a dagger. Now I'm going to just start sharing some stories to give you a sense of this. Enough talking about them. And one more thing, I guess, to say before I share one. I invite you, as you're listening to this story, to ask yourself or bring to your own heart, how or is it possible that in this time this kind of energy is needed? Is it needed from you? And whether you are female identified or male identified in this room doesn't matter. This wisdom, this teaching, this way of being, ask yourself that question as you listen to some of these stories. The Old Woman, Zhao Zhou, and the Tiger. One day, when Master Zhao Zhou was outside the monastery, he saw an old woman hoeing a field. He asked her, "What would you do if you suddenly met a fierce tiger?" She replied, "Nothing in this world frightens me," and turned back to her hoeing. Zhao Zhou roared like a tiger. She roared back at him. Zhao Zhou said, "There's still this." The Old Woman and Naropa. One day, the great Indian scholar Naropa was quietly studying in his room. Suddenly, an intense, startling shadow fell on the floor, and out of it, an old, old woman emerged in front of him. She asked, "What are you reading?" Naropa replied, "I'm studying the teachings of the Buddha." The old woman asked, "Do you understand them?" Without hesitation, Naropa replied, "I understand every single word." "How fortunate for this earth that such a scholar exists," she exclaimed. joyfully, then asked, "You understand the literal meaning of the teachings, but do you understand their inner meaning?" Naropa replied, "Yes." The expression of the old woman transformed from joy to sadness. With trembling heart, she cried, "To think that such a great scholar as you knows how to tell lies." The embarrassed Naropa inquired, "Is there anyone who truly understands the inner meaning of the Dharma?" The old woman answered, "Yes, my brother, Tilopa." Tears came to Naropa's eyes. He asked, "Where can I find this master?" The old woman replied, "He is not in any particular direction. He could be anywhere. If your mind is filled with devotion and you yearn to meet him, that is the right direction." Then the old woman, who was actually Vajra Yogini, an embodiment of enlightened energy in female form, disappeared like a rainbow fading in the sky. Because of his deluded mind, Naropa had not been able to see her true form. We associate these kinds of stories, these teaching stories, koans, with Zen, but they are throughout Buddhism, including from the time of the Buddha. And we're lucky enough to have a series of stories from the women who studied directly with the Buddha. It's the Terigata, the sayings, the enlightenment stories, the poetry of these early women. If you're interested, there's several translations of the Terigata out in the world. A lot of them are also very powerful stories. And this is one of them. This is one of my very favorite stories in the book. Soma rebukes Mara. The nun Soma was a disciple of the Buddha. One day, she was deep in meditation beneath a tree in a forest grove. Mara, the lord of delusion, approached her cloaked in invisibility. He whispered in her ear, "Because a woman has a naturally limited consciousness and the realm of wisdom is so hard to reach, no woman has the ability to attain it." Soma recognized Mara and rebuked him, saying, How could a woman's consciousness be a hindrance when her heart is set on liberation? Am I a woman in these matters or a man? The question has no power over me. Mara, be gone. And he was gone. Sometimes it's said that koans are like a candle flame. This was one life. I think at least some of these women actually existed, maybe many of them, a long time ago. And yet the light can actually, the flame can awaken, enlighten, create a fire in our own hearts and minds. I love to think of these stories as mirrors of our own practice. And that's one of the reasons that I say don't worry about what you understand or don't understand. There is all kinds of cultural context in these. We could dissect any one of these in a thousand ways. But I don't think that's the heart of the matter. I think the heart of the matter is, does some part of that story that we just heard, does it touch something in you? Is there a voice in you that whispers in your ear about your capacities? Here's a woman's teaching about how to meet that. So this question of this quality that comes through so many of these stories, this quality of clarity and strength, I thought that maybe they had to be that way. Because you think about the cultures that held the women that were in these stories, intensely patriarchal cultures. Many, many of these stories, the ones from China and Japan, come out of cultures that were steeped in Confucian understanding. And one of the aspects of, one of the really primary aspects of Confucian teaching was that the relationship between men and women wasn't understood as a cultural form. It was understood as literally the nature of the universe. And to go against it was to violate the laws of the universe. And fundamental to that was that a woman was under the control of a man from her birth to her death. First as a daughter of a father, then as the wife of a husband, or if for some reason she didn't marry, she would be under the direct control of an older brother, older family member. And then as an old woman, under the control of her son. women could not ordain, couldn't go become full-time Buddhist practitioners without the express permission from male family members. This world, in some ways, I think it's hard for us to even imagine the degree of the degree to which women were bound within these cultures. So maybe part of the reason they had to be so powerful was to be able to fully express themselves within that culture. They couldn't afford to only have the sweet side of who they were present. Although I do want to also say that I think within Zen, I think about the stories that Dogen tells about Rujing, his teacher, who'd go around and hit people with his slipper if they were falling asleep, and that Dogen's very clear that he did this out of compassion. Compassion can take a lot of different forms. I find these stories deeply compassionate because they are a reminder to us of our own strength and capacity. That's compassion. That's real compassion. I wanted to share a story that's very hard to hear in our culture, I think, our understanding. I know that when I've brought this story to groups of especially women in workshops and retreats using these koans, this is one that evokes some really strong feeling. So just warning you that it's a strong story. But I think it's an important story because I think it points to what I'm talking about here in terms of the culture that these women are coming from. And of course, part of this culture is also that women are, oddly enough, kind of a reversal from our own culture, seen as more sexual than men and dangerous because of their sexuality, and particularly dangerous to monks because of their sexuality. And we see that all the way back to some of the earliest sutras. Really tragic, its effect on women and their opportunities to practice. This one's called Rionin Scars Her Face. As a young woman, Rionin Genso was an attendant to the Empress and was known for her beauty and intelligence. When the Empress died, she felt the impermanence of life and she decided to become a nun. Rionin traveled to the city of Edo in search of a Zen master. The first teacher refused her because of her beauty. Then she asked Master Hakuo Dotai, who also refused her. He could see her sincere intention, but he too said that her womanly appearance would cause problems for the monks in the monastery. Afterward, she saw some women pressing fabric, and she took up a hot iron and held it against her face, scarring herself. Then she wrote this poem on the back of a small mirror. To serve my empress, I burned incense to perfume my exquisite clothes. Now, as a homeless mendicant, I burn my face to enter a Zen temple. The four seasons flow naturally like this. Who is this now in the midst of these changes? She returned to Hakuo and gave him the poem. Hakuo immediately accepted her as a disciple. She became abbess of his temple when he died and later founded her own temple. Before her death, she wrote the following poem. This is the 66th autumn I have seen. The moon still lights my face. Don't ask me about the meaning of Zen teachings. Just listen to what the pines and cedars say on a windless night. maybe not surprisingly, one of the ways these stories differ from many of the more traditional Zen stories. Many Zen stories are very bodily in ways, referring to various bodily functions quite directly. But a lot of these stories have to do with sexuality. Here's a more lighthearted one. Eshun's Deep Thing. Eshun was a nun at the monastery of Saijoji. The abbot of Saijoji wanted to send a message to the abbot of the great temple of Engakuji, which was known for its rough treatment of outsiders. None of the monks from Saijoji dared to go. Only Eshun was willing to volunteer. When the Engakuji monks saw her walk through the main gate, one of them rushed forward, raised his robes to expose himself, and said, "This monk's thing is 3 feet long. How about it?" Eshun calmly lifted her robes, spread her legs, and said, "This nun's thing is infinitely deep." She dropped her robes and continued down the corridor, unmolested. One of the themes that runs through the books are through the book is encounters by these women with, and you've actually already heard several of them, with some of the greatest teachers of their time, and also some of the scariest teachers of their time. One of the scariest of his time was the Japanese Rinzai teacher Hakuin, and Hakuin pretty much terrified everybody. And the cemetery of his monastery was filled with the graves of monks trying to practice with him, and the practice was so hard and so ascetically demanding that many of them died in the process. But there are also these extraordinary stories, just so beautiful, of Hakuin's encounters with women from the village around his monastery, which was also his home village where he was born. So these were women who almost certainly had known him all his life. And was some of them we know were actually his relatives as well. But just imagine encountering the scariest Zen master of the time. This one's called The Old Woman's Enlightenment. An old woman went to hear Master Hakuin give a lecture. He said, "Your mind is the pure land and your body is Amida Buddha. When Amida Buddha appears, mountains, rivers, forests, and fields all radiate a great light. If you want to understand, look into your own heart." The old woman pondered Hakuin's words day and night, waking and sleeping. One day, as she was washing a pot after breakfast, a great light flashed through her mind. She dropped the pot and ran to tell Hakuin, "Amida Buddha filled my whole body. Mountains, rivers, forests, and fields are all shining with light. How wonderful!" She danced for joy. "What are you talking about?" Hakuin asked. "Does the light shine up your asshole?" Small as she was, she gave him a big push, saying, "I can see you're not enlightened yet." They both burst out laughing. the most extraordinary of all of the women who encountered Hakuin, or who Hakuin encountered, might be more accurate, was a woman named Satsujo, who was actually his niece. And I'm going to share a story with you because I think it's important to understand that grandmotherly mind doesn't always take the form of an old woman. But we have stories from her from literally throughout her lifetime. Satsujo sits on the Lotus Sutra. A devout layman took his young daughter Satsujo with him whenever he visited Hakuin. Though only a child, Satsujo was devoted to practicing the Dharma. When she was 16, her parents were concerned that she would not find a husband and asked her to pray to Kanon, the Bodhisattva of compassion. She did this day and night, during all of her activities. Before long, she experienced an awakening. One day, her father peeked into her room and saw her sitting on a copy of the Lotus Sutra. "What are you doing sitting on this precious scripture?" he shouted. "How is this wonderful sutra different from my ass?" she replied. So that was the 16-year-old Satsujo. And now I want to share a story from near the end of Satsujo's life. As a young woman, Satsujo studied with Master Hakuin Ekoku and attained great enlightenment. When she was old, her granddaughter died, and she was overcome with grief. She wept bitterly at the funeral. An old man from the neighborhood scolded her, saying, "Why are you wailing and carrying on so? People will wonder what sort of enlightenment you experienced. Don't you know there is no birth and no death?" Satsujo shot back at him, "You self-righteous old fool. What do you know about it? My tears and weeping help my granddaughter far more than incense, candles, and the chanting of monks." The old man left without a word. I want to share a story that is not in the book. After this was published, about a year later, I was in Kyoto, and I was visiting a friend of a friend there who is married to a man who spent most of his life as an agronomist, but he was from a family that had been taking care of a temple, a small temple in the middle of Kyoto, for about 900 years or so, and called Kuya-do. And Kuya was a Pure Land Heian period, so very early time in Japan, sort of saint. He would wander the streets of Kyoto singing and chanting and dancing and giving away everything he had. He was actually a younger member of the imperial family, but he had given it all up to become a homeless monk and beg for his food and dance through the streets of Kyoto. Wonderful, inspiring character from Buddhist history. I was visiting Kuyado, and the man who is the current priest of that temple told me this story. As far as I know, I don't know if it's ever been written down anywhere. In Kyoto, still to this day, there is a small pond that was part of the grounds of the imperial palace in the Heian period. And it's about all that's left, actually, of those original grounds. And it's believed, even by contemporary people in Kyoto, that at one time, and maybe even still, a dragon lives in that pond. Kuya, as part of his daily rounds with his begging bowl, would walk by that pond. And every day when he walked by the pond, he would see this old, old, very old beggar woman dressed in rags sitting next to the pond. And he would always share a little bit of the food that he'd been given with her. And one day, she wasn't there. And he was concerned for her safety and well-being. And then she wasn't there the next day, and he got more and more concerned because he was used to seeing her every single day. And finally, after a few days, she reappeared, looking even older and more ragged than she had before. And Kuya went rushing up to her and said, "Oh, I'm so glad to see you. Are you all right? Is there anything I can do? Can I bring you some medicine?" And she said, I have been terribly ill. I believe that I'm dying." And he said, "Well, what can I do for you? How can I help you?" "Anything, anything you ask, I'll do." And she thought about it for a moment and she said, "I would like to spend the night with you." And Kuya turned away because he was renowned for his perfect expression of his vows as a monk, which included celibacy. And the old woman was saying that what she most needed from him was to spend the night with her, to sleep with her. And after a long pause, he turned back to her. And he said, I'm a celibate monk. I don't think I can spend the night with you." And she said, This is my last request. I'm dying." And so he thought about it again. And he turned to her and he said, "You're right, of course. We'll spend the night together." And then she took her true form, which was the dragon. And this huge dragon appeared before him and bowed down to him and said, "This was a test, and you passed." We're in hard times. We all know this. There's a lot of fear. There's a lot of uncertainty. There's a lot of acting out going on at every level, from the personal to the global. I want to suggest that these qualities of compassionate energy, fearlessness, clarity, power, the ability to laugh at oneself or to remind another of laughter, that these two are expressions of our Bodhisattva way. And I also want to remind you that Zazen, the practice that so many of you do here week in and week out together, develops these qualities. You are on the same path as the women whose stories you just heard. And not to be afraid of allowing these qualities to come forward in you, because it's a way that you can actually benefit the world and the people around you. And I talked a little long, but I couldn't help myself. I have like a whole pile of stories I never even got to. I wanted to give Taigen a chance to respond, if he wishes, to any of these stories or anything else that you feel like adding.
Well, just briefly, so that maybe others can respond a little bit too. We are running late, but two things. One is that, yes, about the patriarchal cultures of Asia and of Buddhism, but also here in our culture, there's much prejudice against women. I'm very happy that there are three women priests here in Ashoka who are here. And it's difficult for women in this culture too. And I just want to acknowledge that. And that women are not treated fairly or equally in this culture. So it's important to say that. The other thing that I wanted to say is that you talked about compassion and sweetness and you know, that stereotype of women's practice. But the other thing that comes through for me in all of these stories is the importance of passion. This is a passionate practice. Mm. It looks like we're being very serious and still somber. Sitting Zazen is this very serious stoic thing. This is a passionate practice. We have to care a lot about who we are and how we are and how we take care of our lives and how we take care of our world and how are we taking care of, you know, the next generation and the future and the world around us. This is not some low-key, it's a very passionate practice. And that comes through for me in all the stories. So thank you very much. And I want to leave time for some announcements and also for Florence to, for Tia and Gopis, and for Florence to sign a copy of her book and for you to get copies of the book. But if there's a couple of comments and responses to all these wonderful stories, please feel free. Questions, comments.
And I'd be curious also if anybody wants to respond in this way. You can ask a question, but also, how was it for you to just let those stories reverberate inside you?
Person in my community, and the use of words male and female often is off-putting to them.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the stories as I sat with them washing over me also I felt would be very helpful to them. And to me in trying to understand things that I don't understand. Feeling more female energy. And they said, I don't feel either. Which I had no thought would be a possibility, to be quite honest. So I look forward to giving her a copy.
And just to say, one of the commentaries is by a trans woman in this book, and there's also a commentary about a transgender Sangha member by Catherine Tanas in here. And I know a wonderful young man that I met at Upaya last year who wants to do something like The Hidden Lamp specifically for the queer community, which is really exciting.
But the story that somehow sticks out in my mind was the man who was taking a cold, ice cold shower. And I get it, you know, I'm not going to tell this like it was in the book, but I guess he was kind of moaning and groaning about how painful it was and so on. And so a woman, I guess a nun, said to him, "Well, why do you do this?" And he said, "Well, because of the evil that I have done, or has to be that I do." And she said, "Well, why don't you just stop doing evil, and then you won't have to take this." And because why? He said, "Oh, what a concept."
I'll also say I found, as I return to these stories at different times in my life, different things kind of affect me. That's the way, one of the ways they function as a mirror. I also want to say, if you have a copy from several years ago, you'll notice that this one is thicker. It's actually, they did a new edition with the most fantastic index that is way, way better. Not to encourage you to get another one, but it's seriously, that was one of the weaknesses of the first edition of the book, was that the index was not, this index was done by a guy named Michael Brackney, who is the very, very best indexer of serious Buddhist scholarly books. So we're...
He did the index of the paperback of the Dogen's extensive record.
Yeah, he's just amazing. So we're super lucky now to have that. And you can look up just about anything. And I want a story about a cow, you know, and you'll find it. You'll find it in there. So anyway, thank you all for... I've never presented in this way all the many, 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 many times that I've taught from The Hidden Lamp. And I thank you for being willing to experiment with me and see how it was to let those stories in like, I don't know, water coming into your heart. So, thank you.
Thank you. Let's close formally with the 4:47.